We all love mob movies. Scarface, The Godfather, the list goes on and on. But there's one movie that speaks to me above all others. Donnie Brasco starring Johnny Depp. In season one of Deep Cover, we discovered the real story behind Donnie's time undercover with the New York Mafia and what it was like spending 6 years with some of the wildest wise guys you'll ever come across. I'm your host, Leo Rossi, and I've spent my life behind and in front of the cameras, creating stories about the mob. This season, we're going even deeper into the Donnie Brasco story. We'll learn more about the man behind the persona, Joe Pistone, and his time as the most decorated undercover agent in FBI history.
This week on Deep Cover, the real Donnie Brasco. After years of harassment, Joe had reached his breaking point, and the time for him to walk away had come. He talks with Leo about the last confrontation that led him to finally turn in his badge and gun.
Listeners out there, this is Leo Rossi. I'm the host of Deep Cover, the real Donnie Brasco, and I am here with Joe Pistone, who is the real Donnie Brasco. Yeah, hi, Joe. How are you?
Okay, Leo. Just going to say, I hope you're doing well.
Well, thank you. Yeah, how are you doing, Joe? This is like social amenities.
I'm doing great, Leo.
That's good, good, good. Let me try, and you interrupt me at any moment, Joe, to bring the audience up to speed about what was in the last episode, which was you in the Southern field office that you were assigned having problems with the SAC, that special agent in charge. Would you mind? I mean, I know you. It's the SAC, and I know it stands for special agent in charge. But with what came out in the last episode, which I'm recapping, I like to call him the special asshole in charge. Does that offend you, Joe?
No, that's that. Yeah, that's not. That's,
all right, I won't do that. All right. Just I want you to know where my sentiment is. All right, my buddy.
Well, I appreciate it, but no.
Okay. In the FBI, all agents have to be assigned to a field office. And in that field office, the special agent in charge, he is graded on his team of agents, how many arrests they have, how many convictions they have, and that figures into his bonus. Okay, that sounds pretty good. Now, you were assigned to the Southern field office, and you were doing, at that time, trials in Milwaukee, trials in Florida, trials in New York City, risking your life to go in front of these grand juries, everything, and you also had at your home 50 miles, yes, let me say that again, 50 miles from the field office, you had electronic equipment, you had big phone setups because you were talking multiple trials, many U.S. attorneys, and it was a real, real technical setup in your home.
Correct.
Well, the SAC wanted you to come into the office, 50 miles one way to sign in, and then 50 miles back the other way. For what? So he can flex his muscle. He's the boss. You fought that and you told him, you know, listen, this is not cool here, man. And then he started snooping. He started snooping around. And as we talked about, that $250,000 that Tony Mira accused you of on a drug deal of walking away with, he was filtering things to the higher ups in the FBI that, you know, maybe Joe has that because his wife just bought a brand new Cadillac. This is the intensity of where this was, where we left it. And you had going to bat for you, not only Rudy Giuliani, who went right to Webster, the head of the FBI. You went Louis Free.
Barbara Jones. Jules Monavolante.
Jules, your rabbi. Okay, so that's where we are. Did I miss anything?
Well, yeah, that's a good recap.
Okay. You want to get A, B, C, C plus? Okay. That's a
pretty good recap.
All right. So you have been pushed to your limit. Your wife, Maggie, told our boy, the SAC, off or let him know her feelings. She shoots as straight as you can shoot. So take us from there, your breaking point.
As I said, Lee, I was involved in all these trials, and it wasn't one trial, you know, it was several trials at one time. Trial in the Eastern District, the Southern District, Milwaukee. So I'm prepping for all these trials, and I'm not getting any slack from this gentleman. And I think it was in July or maybe August. I'm on vacation, but I'm prepping for a trial. I'm actually at the Jersey Shore. I get a call from somebody questioning me about different things, where I was, what I was doing.
Somebody from the FBI's investigative unit? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, somebody from the office that I was assigned to. So that was it. So I said to my wife, you know something? I'm quitting. I'll still do my testifying. I'll do everything I have to do, but I'm quitting. So she says, well, you do what you got to do.
Whoa.
You do what you have to.
This is some decision. How long had you been an FBI agent?
17 years. 3 years short of a retirement pension.
It's just very difficult for me to not understand your breaking point, but let you walk away, the most highly decorated undercover agent in history?
Well, what happened? I'm the only FBI agent that I know of that resigned on a telephone. So I called FBI headquarters, told them who I was.
Oh, that's so you, buddy. That is so you.
told them where I was, and I just wanted to let them know I resigned. And whoever was on the phone, I can't remember, you know, they said, you can't resign on a telephone. I said, well, I just did. Next thing I know, my phone's ringing off the hook. When I hung up, I called Jules Bonavolante and told him. I said, Jules, I just resigned. I just quit. And he said, are you crazy? You know, he gave me the spiel. And I said, forget it. I'll do everything that the FBI asked me to do as far as trials and everything. But I quit. My phone didn't stop ringing. It didn't stop ringing. You know, people trying to talk me out of resigning.
Well, what were they saying to you? Why you shouldn't? Well, there's a lot of reasons.
Well, you know, basically you're acting out of haste. You know, you can't let this bother you. The normal, you only got 3 years to go. This guy's probably be gone, you know. And I said, no, that's it. I've been dealing with it. And although everybody's sticking up for me, I'm still getting harassed. So I get a call. A good friend of mine was an agent out of Atlantic City. So he calls me and he says, hey, Joe, this is Dick. Hey, Dick, how you doing? You at the beach? Yeah, you know. He was embarrassed to tell me that he was tasked to come up and pick up my gun and credentials.
That is such bullshit.
I said, don't be embarrassed. You're my friend. You're only doing what you have to do. So he come up the next day, picked him up. And I eventually got around to, well, you know, you have to fill out papers and everything. And that's how I left after 17 years over the telephone.
Did Webster call you at any point in time?
No. But other people from headquarters did, like Jules, Sean McQueenie, the head of the criminal investigation division. I got a lot of phone calls from people telling me to, you know, not to do it. Don't act so harsh and rash. Louis Free, Barbara Jones, Rudy, everybody. But I just said, hey, forget it. I'm not dealing with it anymore.
You still had trials to attend, correct?
Oh, I had plenty of trials, sure.
But you weren't on the payroll, so
I didn't get paid for testifying. I mean, they paid for my airfare to get where I had to go, but I didn't get any compensation for testifying. No, huh?
But you did have protection FBI agents with you to protect you?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. The FBI, I don't have any beef there. You know, it's how government bureaucracy works, you know? I mean, you got somebody that's two steps above you, and the way the government works, you're not going to beat them. Doesn't make any difference who you are.
And he wasn't a big proponent, you've said that before, of undercover agents.
He did not. In all fairness, I don't think it wasn't me personally. I was an undercover agent. I was in his office, but not doing any good for his office.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I wasn't giving his office any stats, but I was accounted against his agent compliment. So it could have been anybody. It was just a situation. He was straight go by the book, didn't like undercover, thought all agents had to come in the office every day and sign in and sign out. And
I can agree with what you're saying. There is bureaucracy. There's by the book people. We need them too and everything. But what I really am trying to get down to the root of is this $250,000. Where does he get off saying that to higher ups? And then microscopically, Maggie bought a car, it happened to be a Cadillac, and he's bringing that up to people. Now, that's different. That's different going by the book at all. He's, in his offhanded way, making accusations about your character. Damn.
I guess he was, but everybody has their own thoughts. They do what they do, and that's the way I looked at it. Look, I knew that every day I could get up and look at myself in the mirror and I could shave and not feel embarrassed or ashamed of who I was. Now that I was out, Lou DiGiamo comes to me. You know my friend Lou DiGiamo.
Casting agent, one of the best in New York City. God rest his soul. Yeah.
He comes to me and says, I can get you a book deal. So I actually talked to Jules and I talked to Louis Free, because Louis was the prosecutor.
Sure.
And I said, would it hurt? And they said, no, you're free to do what you want to do.
And these were top-notch attorneys that knew all the different ramifications, and they give you their blessing.
Exactly. And then what happened was, the funny part is that I do all this testifying, and I can't tell you how many trials. And at that time, I know that I had more time on the witness stand than any agent as far as testifying in continuous cases. Then what happens is that the FBI asked me to go back and lecture at Quantico on organized crime and undercover. But, like I said, to me, the FBI is the greatest law enforcement agency in the world, I mean, when I was in, and the BRIC agents still are. You can't fault headquarters for all the work the BRIC agents do.
BRIC meaning the guys that hit the bricks.
Yeah, the guys that are on the street doing the investigations. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the way it worked.
Well, but here's the thing. You weren't getting paychecks anymore.
No, I wasn't.
No, even though they're picking up your expenses to go to all the trials and all the different jurisdictions, that's no money coming in.
No.
So, all right, you have a potential book deal, but what did Joseph D. Pistone, what were your future plans? What were you saying you were going to get into?
I had no idea, Leo. I had no idea because I was so wrapped up in the cases, in testifying, I couldn't go out and get a job. So, I was just living off of savings, actually.
That sucks. Excuse me for, look, yes, you did resign. Okay. You did that on your own volition, but, and the guys all tried.
On the telephone, Leo.
Yes. On the telephone. Oh my God.
You know, anybody that resigned on the telephone?
See, don't resign on this phone.
It's funny now, isn't it?
Yeah. It wasn't a bowl of cherries when you did it. So, I mean, you must have had it like in your mind, okay, the book was coming up. You got a blessing to do that. And that's a lot of work. And tell everybody who you wrote it with.
Richard Woodley.
Richard Woodley. That's who it was. Richard Woodley.
Great writer. Yeah. And Lou introduced me to an agent named Carmen Levia.
Yes.
God rest his soul. It was with Fifi Asgard Agency, a small agency in New York.
Great literary guy.
God rest Fifi's soul.
Yep.
And that was it. I didn't have any, I wasn't thinking movie or anything else. I just said, hey, you know, if I get a book, great. It'll give me some, you know, it'll give me some breathing room.
Sure.
Until I can find a job.
Oh, man, I'm thinking of ways as soon as your trial obligations are over. And that was over a long period of time. Almost what, 10 years in you testifying?
I think the last case I testified in might have been in maybe 94 or something.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a long, it's a lot of trials, Leo, a lot of trials.
But, you know, people minimize, I do. I'm not going to speak for other people. What a mental strain it is to be on the witness stand and having said so many things before to remember what you had said before, because they're looking. They're looking to catch you in one sentence that skews different from what you said in previous trials.
Exactly. You went to a year of law school. You know that when you're in a trial, that's what they try to get you on, you know, your previous testimony. And now you're testifying today, and you may have testified 6 months ago. You better know what you testified to then. So you can imagine when I'm in my fifth and sixth trial, being that it, you know, everything was wrapped up into one case, basically, even though they were different jurisdictions. When I'm on my sixth trial, not only am I prepping for that number six, but I got to go back over all my testimony from one to five.
I mean, it must have been reams of paperwork.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
And all that time, was there one, two episodes where you did misspeak when you were on the stand?
Yeah, there was one time. Not that I misspoke, but I forgot something. Sonny Black had given me when he gave me the contract to kill Bruno, he gave me a gun, pistola.
Deep Cover will be right back after this short message. And we're back with Deep Cover.
I had taken the grips off and I had scratched in my initials and the date and then put the grips back on. Well, when I was on the stand being cross-examined by the defense attorney, he asked me how I could recognize the gun. And I just, you know, I described the caliber and the make and everything. And he said, did you make any markings? And I completely forgot. And I said, no. And then later on, you know, it dawned on me, oh, I did. But don't forget, it happened, you know, years before, you know, a couple of years before. So I told the prosecutor on a break and, you know, they come back and cleaned it up. But other than that, I had a pretty good memory when it came to recall the case, my conversations, and my prior testimony. I was lucky in that I had pretty good recall on that.
Actually, next episode, we're going to deal with the tapes and we're going to play the tapes, stop, start. It's really a thing of beauty because you were so into Donnie Brasco and the belief of the guys around you. I mean, it was an acting to a defense. I mean, it was so you were part of this whole fabric. And when people hear you talking to Sonny Black, talking to Lefty, talking to other guys, and, you know, I did listen, as we have been doing, you know, the tapes were sent to me, too. And Johnny Depp did capture your rhythm and some of your pronunciations. Really.
Yeah, he did, didn't he?
Oh, he's spot on. I went.
Yeah. Yes, he did.
Holy shit. I mean, that was perfect.
Yeah. He's amazing.
When you are, you know, in these trials and there still is that $500,000 over your head, it's just bittersweet that it had to end that way. Yes. All right. The audience heard. I heard. But where is the respect, for God's sakes? I mean, Where is the appreciation? Not that you were, you know, trying to glom thing, but I'll tell you one thing, and you answer this, and I have my feelings. When you, which you were within your rights, were going to write that book, boy, the jealousy must have popped out all over the place. Oh, man.
Oh, well, it may have, but nobody ever mentioned that to me. I mean, you know, the working agents, the street agents, the agents that have been, you know, that are out on the bricks. I mean, I have got nothing but thanks and, you know, great job, et cetera, from these guys, you know, and gals, actually. In fact, we'll get into this later, but I did go back into the FBI.
Oh, yeah. We'll go back into that. Yeah. Yeah.
I did go back in and we'll get into why I went back in later on. But when I was in at Quantico, I had several new agents that were in agents training come up and say, you're the reason why we joined the FBI. And I had a couple female agents come up and say that to me, which makes you good, feel good. Because like I say, the working agents, they know every, you know, they know what's going on and they respect good investigations. Hey, Leo.
Yes.
Let me tell you a story. Everybody talks about the FBI and law enforcement being trigger happy and everything, right?
Yeah.
I'll give you the thinking of the FBI. We get a call. I get a call. Guy's got a bank robbery set up, right? So they say, Donnie, it's your job to get the guns for this bank robbery. What they were going to do is actually not rob the bank, but rob the armored car when it got to the bank, all right?
Okay.
So they had scoped it out. They had everything going. I said, yeah, okay, I can get the guns. So I talked to the attorney, the strike force attorney, and he says, yeah, go ahead. He said, but what I want you to do is have your firearms guy make the guns inoperable. I said, okay. They had a big plan to make the arrest once we started to do the robbery. So that was the Department of Justice's attorney that told me, right? And he told the, you know, the agents that were running the case. So we said, okay, so we got to send it up to the legal department of the FBI at FBI headquarters. So the headquarters came back and said, no way. There's no way you're going to do that. Do what? You can't render these guns inoperable. Why not? Well, because suppose you get in the shootout, the bad guys won't be able to defend themselves.
Oh!
I said, wait a minute. The bad guys won't be able to defend. That's what we want. No, because then, you know, then it'd be like we're murdering them because, you know, their guns won't fight, you know, won't be able to fire.
Oh, no, no.
So for people who think that, you know, that we're out there looking to kill everybody, that's the mindset of the FBI anyway. What we did was the day that the robbery was going to go down, we just had the police flood the area with some marked units. So the guy said, hey, there's a lot of cops around. So,
boy, that would have been Jesse James style. Going in there with
one way. They would have been shooting blanks.
Yeah. That's a life and death situation. And that it didn't, that it didn't go over, go off.
Yeah.
So now I know you well, very well. You stayed in shape, you know, in the interim when, you know, you were traveling to trials. Then you were writing the book with Mr. Woodley, and you were always working out, keeping in shape, right?
Yes. Yeah, I was. I always made sure that stayed in a hotel where they had a gym, a good gym, or I belonged to a health club. So I'd go, you know, that's nationwide. I'd go there. But yeah, I always worked out.
I was an actor at the time and all, but when the whole Donnie Brasco thing came, your picture was in the paper, correct?
No, it was drawings, just drawings.
Oh, drawings from on the trial, right. And so when did your picture, either in the paper or in some periodical, when did that surface? Can you remember exactly where you went, oh, shit?
Yeah.
Because it would have been easy to glom a shot.
It was probably during one of the trials, but I don't remember which one.
And you, you're teaching at Quantico, and the word is that you resigned. I'm telling you, man, you cut a swath through this. It's there's never been anybody like that. Well, that's you, buddy, you know, all the way. Okay. We still have to know when you did make your decision to, hey, guys, I want back in. And that did come to a point, correct?
Yes, it did. Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, that's a long story, too, how I got back in.
Okay. All right.
I had individuals, you know, I had important individuals ask me to come back over the course of several months. So I did make the decision, but that's another story.
Yeah, no, no. Well, and we'll get to it. I would just imagine that if I was the head of a security firm or, you know, something like that, man, I'd be jumping out of my socks to get Joe Pistone on my team, you know?
I had offers, Leo, but, you know, when you're tied up in so many, in court with so many cases, I mean, you know, you can't work an 8-hour job or 10-hour job. Yep. And prepare for court because, you know, if the trial's in Milwaukee, you got to be in Milwaukee. You know, you might be there for 2-3 weeks. The trial's in the Eastern District, the trial's in Florida. You know, it's not like you're there for one day, couple of days. You're there for, you know, for 2-3 weeks at a clip.
And I mean, and let's face it, you're the superstar. I mean, you know, when you're there.
Well, you know, I was the main witness.
Yeah. Know? No. All right. Well, I think the audience is going to be very curious how you came back into the FBI, because you certainly laid out how you left the FBI just over the old telly. Is that right? Uh-huh. That fits your mold,
bro. That's it.
That fits your mold.
Telephone call. You can't quit on the phone. Yeah, I just did.
Oh, you sounded like Nicholson. You can't, what did he say in the movie? Like, you can't you can't take it or whatever it was.
You can't handle the truth. You can't handle the truth.
That's it. All right, Jack. I mean, Joe. It's all good. Thank you, everybody. Joseph, as usual, you're the man.
Thank you, Leo.
Okay.
God bless.
Oh, bye-bye.
Next week on Deep Cover, we get an even deeper look into Joe's life undercover with the release of another tape. You'll hear a never-been-heard-before conversation between Donnie the Jeweler, Lefty Two Guns Ruggiero, and fellow undercover agent Tony Conti. Keep listening to Deep Cover, The Real Donnie Brasco, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. Thanks to our producer, Monique Nethington, sound designer, Casey Franco, music and voiceover by me, Camille Stennis, and executive producers, Maddie Stout, Rudy Solo, and MBB Media for putting this episode together. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for more Deep Cover updates, plus exclusive photos and content.